The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 132, a panel discussion, Local Humanitarians, What Your Ward Can Do.
Good morning, or late morning, as the case may be. I'm going to stand up and get us started, though I'm not sure whether there should supposed to be someone here introducing the people who are introducing. My name is John Lear, and I live here in Salt Lake City. I'm now going to paraphrase from my own biography, which I was going to hand to somebody else. In 1976, I helped organize the B.H. Roberts Society. I have a law degree from the University of Utah and basically have been involved with environmental activities all over the country and all over the world since then. Well, I guess my wife would get after me if I didn't recognize her and the fact that we have three children mucking around in various segments of the community someplace. As a practical matter, though, I have, in betwixt and between what I try to do to keep body and soul together, have been involved in a series of community programs, which I think is what got me started here this morning. We have a panel discussion, and by the informality of my co-panelists, I would really like to make it a room discussion as opposed to a panel discussion. I think we're going to have plenty of time to talk back and forth to one another. Hopefully, we can discuss some of the issues and some of the vignettes that we will be discussing. From left to right, let me at least introduce by name in advance, and I'll do so more formally at the time they speak, my co-panelists. We have Susan Anderson on my immediate right, who is from Salt Lake. Laga Van Beek, did I do that well? And from Australia, but you are currently at the Y. And awaiting her children's arrival anxiously this afternoon. And John Hurd from Boulder, Colorado is on the far right. We're going to try this morning to maybe give you an outline, some ideas about this concept of, as it's listed at least in the program that I received, if I can get to the right page, Local Humanitarians, What Your Wards Can Do. I'd like to change that a little bit. In my judgment, I don't think this is a discussion of humanitarianism per se. I feel a little bit like the Wizard of Oz when they started, and if I can quote it somewhat accurately, it goes, philant, 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 good deed doers. This is not a discussion about good deed doers. In my judgment, this is a discussion about the building of community. And I think if we can approach the topic that way, we may be able to unburden ourselves a little bit from that notion of there go the philanthropists or there go the good deed doers, when in fact what we are all contributing to is community. I'm going to make some quick comments here, hopefully quick, as an outline in terms of what I hope will begin to set some tone about all of this. In 1976, not long after the Sonia Johnson episodes, when a number of us were feeling somewhat alienated and estranged, of course I felt that way all the time, and as children of the 60s, that seemed to be kind of the rhythm of things. We started the B.H. Roberts Society with then, in conjunction with then what was more of a fledgling Sunstone, really as a place to build community for people of like minds. Since that time, I've come to understand that while important, the building of intellectual communities is not sufficient and probably not particularly central to our ultimate spiritual, or at least our I won't say spiritual, but our celestial growth and well-being. Building intellectual communities, while of interest, is not sufficient and, in fact, is not really the most important reason of why we're right here on Earth. While it is interesting and often stimulating and occasionally enlightening, it has in recent years become more of a forum by which we express our intellectual egotism and individual discomfort with what we are, with what are sometimes real and sometimes perceived injustices of the church. The discussion today is about expanding, at least for me. It is about expanding that definition of community to include what I believe is ultimately its central feature, and that is our personal involvement in creating neighborhoods, towns, and regions of not only intellect, but of body and of heart, where we can create a place like the city of Enoch, where there are no poor among us. I believe an effort to focus on this type of comprehensive creation of communities, the same kinds of communities our fathers and mothers struggled to build here in Illinois, in Missouri, and in Ohio, is essential. Efforts to create physical places of brick and mortar, bone and sinew, that address more than simply our intellectual needs and allow us to demonstrate our full commitment to our Savior and our fellow man, I believe is in fact the central reason for our existence. If there is not a connection between what we do and say, then we are all the tinkling cymbals and brass that we hear so much about in the Bible. Should we choose to really recommit ourselves to this expanded definition of community, I suspect many of the intellectual problems and conflicts that have occupied or preoccupied so many of us over the last several years will begin to recede in its importance as we literally are overwhelmed by the daily work of relieving suffering and discomfort of many around us as we build living communities that are of real substance to us and to the individual whom we follow. The question, I suppose, becomes, how have we, perhaps, if that's fair, how has 1990, how have we gotten to where we are? How can we return, if we want to call it that, to earlier values? How did we get off track? I think quickly a historical analysis that I know Lega will go into more detail, particularly as it relates to the Relief Society, is important before we move on. This could be a paper in and of itself, not one that I'm prepared to give, but I'll quickly go through some kinds of incidents. I think probably that departure came in about, or started to come in about 1857 with Johnson's army, when Brigham had to make a fundamental choice, which was he going to be an independent community or were we going to, in fact, reintegrate ourselves? You have a wonderful example of the change in his mind between John D. Lee's activities down at Mountain Meadow and finally our agreement to let Sidney Albert Johnston come into this valley in September of 1857. From my perspective, that's when Utah got on the federal dole and we haven't gotten off. Since then, as you know, we provided provisions for the troops and have been ever since. In 1857 to 56, Brigham knew what the problem was and he struggled through the notion of retrenchment. Because what was happening was that the center of our religious community and our economic and political lives were being split. And government and other kinds of activities and economy was taking away what had been, in fact, an integrated community to that time. By 1876 through 1905, in the period of polygamy, we fundamentally divided our community activity from our religious and intellectual lives for the most part. That is, if it had anything to do with people other than Mormons. I think since 1915 through 1994, we've basically lived in that kind of a context where the political and economic and social side of our existence has been separated from the moral and spiritual sides of our existence. No wonder we got a lot of time to sit around and think about issues rather than doing anything about them, because the mechanisms and means by which one accomplishes the construction of communities has been divided away from the fundamental essence of the church. What I believe this discussion about is an effort to bring those back together in some sort of meaningful way. And I guarantee you if we do that, we will not have time for interminable debates about any number of issues. We will be too busily engaged in the construction of what I believe is the central notion of community. Well, what can we do? I think we can, even within the context of the current institution, within the context of the current political system and economy that we find ourselves in 1994 and on our way into the 20th century, we can begin to close that gap. It doesn't take action from the prophet. It doesn't take action from the regional representatives or the president or the state government. It takes action by us as individual members of our own wards, should we choose to exercise it. Let me give you some quick examples of the kinds of things that I think we could begin to do, particularly in Salt Lake, where there's nearly a ward on every corner. I see no reason why priesthood quorums or bishops or wards could not turn those facilities into community centers or daycare centers. I see no reasons why quorums, rather than organized to support simply those of us who happen to be members, could not be organized along neighborhood lines. Where home teaching means going to simply the people who are, not meaning going to simply the people who are active in wards, but rather to every member who is a member of the community in which we live, and that means member or non-member. Where home teaching means going out with non-members to find out how our neighbors are doing, whether they are alive intellectually, morally, physically, what we can do to be neighbors with them. If we begin to search for issues of community interest, sidewalks, street lamps, it doesn't have to be overwhelming. It simply has to be something that draws us together as human beings and allows us to begin working in a community that is broader than our membership in the church and our membership in a political party or our intellectual curiosity, which may be the same, but draws us together in our common humanity. Focus of organization and stakes can then begin to do those things in the community at large that supports what's going on in the neighborhoods. We don't have to be isolated. I found this to be particularly true and gratifying in my own experience with the construction of the homeless shelter. In 1985, then-Mayor Palmer DePaulis approached me about what could we do, how could we figure out to address the homeless issue. And after reviewing it, it became clear to me that our only hope was in not a governmental effort, to which most of us essentially have delegated responsibility, but rather in a community of interest where the religious and political and economic forces in the community came together, frankly, in their own self-interest to begin to address this problem. Happily, the Mormon Church was absolutely responsive in that regard, along with the Catholic Church and the Episcopal Church and many other religious communities. It gave us something to work together around, and I believe was the beginning of what ultimately resulted in the contributions to the Cathedral of the Madeleine and a great deal of additional work that has been done between institutions since then. But that's the kind of community that we need to begin and we need to start. If we could do this, and we can go into some of those vignettes in detail if you would like, this would, in my judgment, constitute a revolution of the way we approach ourselves and the rest of the world. And perhaps selfishly, it would provide communities that we can live in that are humane, safe, economically stable, friendly places where we ourselves can reside side by side with non-members. No longer do we have to live in isolation, in quiet desperation with our neighbors next door. But rather, if we can begin to see the church in what I think it was originally, an active community-building mode where all members who were committed to the construction of the city of God, of Zion, helped one another. Now, while we may not be able to get everybody to join, I believe we can find those issues, we can use the institutions we have as a means to not only intellectually but actively recreate and reshape the environment around us. Now, those are my feelings about this topic. And in the immortal words of Thomas More, I trust I don't make myself too obscure. That's a little bit of a paraphrase. I'd like now for our panel members to talk about their experiences, which come at different levels, about this notion of community. First, and we might as well go from your right to left, we'll start with Susan. Susan is a volunteer and public relations coordinator with the Traveler Aid Society of the Salt Lake Community Shelter. So Susan is going to be able to tell you a little bit more about the shelter operation and how we've integrated. Susan, why don't we start, and then I'll introduce the rest of the members of the panel from there. If you have questions, let's open up a dialogue. We'll make this informal. They call me the moderator, but I am by definition immoderate, so let's do what we can to answer any questions. So if you have questions for any of us, within reason, we'll try to accommodate those. And I see none, so Susan?
Do you want me to use them?
You may, any way you would like.
I appreciate being here. I was asked to be a panel member, I think, because of the experiences at the Salt Lake Community Shelter and Resource Center that we have in working with wards in the community to help us. And so my focus may be a little bit narrower than the other panelists as far as what I have to say. But in general, I think that the whole idea of you need to start, you can start big and work in, or you can start in and work out, but either way I think you end up with the result of community building. So I'll start in and work out for my discussion. There is a huge homeless population in Salt Lake City, and it is, as John said, in the early 1980s the city began to address this issue and wonder what to do for the care of the homeless. Was there adequate shelter? Was there adequate needs being met? And it was decided that no, we didn't have enough for the homeless. And again, it was a group of people coming together that decided what the focus would be to help the homeless. And a committee was formed called the Shelter the Homeless Committee. And it was comprised of people, citizens, governments, entities, business that were interested in resolving the issue of homelessness. And from that, we acquired the Salt Lake Community Shelter and Resource Center in 1988. It was opened. It was renovated from the Wells Fargo warehouse and the White Westinghouse warehouse. If you're familiar with Salt Lake, it is on 455 West, 2nd South. And from there, I think our name says it all. It's the Salt Lake Community Shelter and Resource Center, and we emphasize with that community. We rely very heavily on the community to help. Part of the work that I do is go out to schools and to various places, businesses, and educate and advocate, I believe, in part for the homeless. And a question that I always get asked is, you know, why are people there and what can we do to help? I think people are there because they fall through all the other sources of assistance. We have a belief, I think, in the United States and in Utah and in Salt Lake and maybe even throughout the world that things are just covered. I think in the United States we feel that government maybe just covers the cracks. But I have found working among the homeless and the poor that they fall through all the cracks, especially people that you would think are already being assisted. For instance, they estimate one-third of all the homeless are veterans. We already have quite a few veteran assistance programs in place, so you would wonder why then are veterans a high number of veterans homeless if we have so many VA programs. We also serve elderly persons at the shelter, which I always wonder why there too. If we think in place in our community are already existing programs to assist the elderly, then why do they find themselves at the shelter? We think that single mothers with children are covered. We have programs for them. What I'm trying to say is that it's kind of an illusion that everything is covered and taken care of, especially by a government entity. So often we need to, I think, not get caught up in the thought that it's all taken care of. And sometimes I think in our community in Salt Lake, we also think that we're covered, those in the church are just covered. But we've had a lot of LDS families at the shelter also. And so obviously they have fallen through the crack. People that are homeless and come to the shelter are using the shelter as their source of a safety net, similar to the way most of us use our parents, our family, the church, our neighbors for assistance. These folks are people that don't have another source of help. I have never seen a problem among the homeless that is not also manifested in the community. People ask me all the time, do you have people on drugs? Do you have people that have alcohol problems? Well, yes, of course. We have people at the shelter who abuse alcohol, abuse drugs. We have people that cannot handle finances very well. We have people with low education. But I've seen that in the community, too. There are, you know, if you were to look at my checkbook, you might wonder why I don't live at the shelter. So it isn't, the homeless don't have a monopoly on those problems. What they don't have is a source of private help for those problems. So they have to turn to the community or I hate to say public assistance because that sounds like a government program, but I'm going to say community assistance. We as a community become their safety net. We become their source of help. We are the ones that can step in and give direction, provide support, and give them some hope so that they can make some changes in their lives. The same way that most people get support and help and guidance through a parent or a friend or a bishop or a concerned Relief Society president or Elders Quorum president. There, all of those things work for the majority of people. For the homeless, they turn to other ways of getting help that most of us would never consider unless we were in their situation. Now, as far as response from the community, it is wonderful. We have a very positive outlook for ourselves in the community. Where we'd like to end homelessness, I don't foresee it ending in the near future. So we kind of have a dual direction. We always have in the back of our minds a hope that homelessness will end, but a realistic goal that while we still have it, we can manage it and work with the issue in a positive way. And we have had much of our positive support given through the community, through one-on-one interaction, more than a lot of cash coming into the shelter. I think people coming into the shelter can help. And I was supposed to talk a little bit on what awards can do. We have had quite a few wards in the city, in the state, even in Brigham City, St. George, have come up and help us. And all of their, it isn't a mandated thing that they come to the shelter and help us. But usually what I find is there's a few dynamic people in that ward that are kind of the moving force behind the support. We have someone who really wants to help the homeless, who wants to help the indigent transient population in Salt Lake, and that person kind of rallies the troops back at the ward for this cause. And we've had wards give us year-long support and ongoing support. We have the Crescent 20th Ward in Sandy has now for the fourth year in a row sponsored a children's barbecue and swim party where the whole ward gets involved in taking the kids swimming into a barbecue. We serve about 70 children a night at the shelter between the ages of infants and 18 years old. We serve about 244 single men and 40 single women. So, and then there's about 35 to 40 parents. We serve single fathers, single mothers. We've had grandmothers with children at the shelter. We have two-parent households that are not your traditional-looking homeless family. We've had families that had older parents with teenagers that don't kind of fit what we think is the stereotypical-looking homeless family. So I think you'd be surprised at the diversity among the homeless and their backgrounds. So we serve a large population. Most of our volunteer efforts are focused towards the children. Volunteers can really give some good basic support to children. Their parents are usually in crisis, and the support that is given often is helpful for the child and the parent. They do some modeling. Volunteers model to children some good role modeling for them. Without the community support, I don't think the shelter would be in existence. Some people have argued that the shelter is in existence because it was, and the homeless are in existence because the shelter was created. That is a myth that is easily dispelled. There were homeless before the shelter, and if the shelter burned down tomorrow and it no longer existed, there would still be homeless. So we need to, I think, focus on what we can do to help people be part of the community. The best way to help someone, like a homeless person, is to help them feel a part of and take ownership in the community. Most of the homeless people feel estranged from the community. They don't feel a part of it. They don't fit in. They don't see themselves as fitting in. And so sometimes it isn't enough that we provide for them food, shelter, clothing, and a possibility of a low-income housing unit. What they need more is to feel a sense of belonging, ownership, part of, integrated back into the community so they can be a positive force with the rest of us, hopefully. That is harder to do. That's not as tangible as giving some clothes, but it is what will make more of a lasting difference. And I would like to extend that beyond just the homeless. Any group of people that are kind of outcast in the community are indigent or impoverished or feeling like they don't belong for whatever reason there is, you know, part of community of getting involved as a ward, as a community back, is to help those people feel like they belong. And there's a learner and a teacher involved. It isn't necessarily letting them be a part of our world, but also opening our world up to be more inclusive of what is in their world that they could share as well. So I would say that more involvement would be beneficial, would create a better sense of community, and the real difference is made when people connect directly with people. That is when I think lives begin to change, focuses change, and people begin to feel a sense of acceptance. Yes, we do need the community, the wards in the city, the stakes in the city and in the state to get involved. And I would say that every homeless community throughout the United States and the world needs the people in their own area to get involved. And through that help, I think we can begin to break down the barriers that keep people in poverty and despair, and we can create a sense of hope and belonging, and we can all begin to identify with each other instead of having a we and a they society. And those are my comments. And afterwards, if you have questions, I'm still here.
Susan, thank you. Lest we think that these problems are, the issues of community are only relevant to 1994, Laga is going, let me introduce her briefly. As I've said, a native of Australia, currently at BYU. She is a PhD student at BYU and teaches in the Women's Studies program. Laga will be talking about the historical role of the Relief Society, and I've added my own comments in the sense that it probably is a description of its de-evolution as opposed to its evolution. So, Laga.
Hope I don't disappoint you then. Okay, the Relief Society organization has a long history of charitable work both within the church and within the broader community. In the March 1924 Relief Society lesson on social service, it states, "Welfare or social work is, in a general sense, any work that is undertaken deliberately for the purpose of bettering the environment or of assisting men to a better adjustment of this environment. established by Joseph Smith in 1842 to relieve the poor and save society with its motto, Charity Never Faileth, the Relief Society took its charge seriously. By 1876, 30 years after first entering the valley, and just 7 years after Brigham Young had asked Eliza R. Snow to oversee the Relief Society's reorganization, 110 branches of the Relief Society had been established. Having learned its responsibility well, the Relief Society had raised and dispersed $82,397, 73% going to the relief of the poor. In the next 5 decades, Mormon women working through the Relief Society were involved in an impressive array of local, state, and national social welfare endeavors, including maternity and child care, environmental concerns, the juvenile court, a minimum wage law, equal guardianship for children, fund drives, defense efforts, Near Eastern relief, and support of the Shepherd Town and Maternity and Infant Protection Acts. These concerns parallels the issues of non-Mormon reform-minded women of the time period, and the Relief Society worked closely with other charity groups within the community. For example, in an editorial in the Relief Society magazine in 1926, the sisters expressed their gratitude for the donations and fastings of the members of the church for Near Eastern relief, specifically for donating money to orphans in Turkey. The article mentions that LDS women worked together with community groups to make this ambitious project work. Extensive involvement in the same national and state issues by both the Relief Society and other reform groups suggests these concerns were women-orientated rather than religiously driven. And just another example of that, in 1910, we had an anti-expectoration, anti-spitting law on the books. And Sharon Carver, who's currently working on a dissertation looking at female influence in local government during 1910 to 1930, found this delightful example of the Relief Society sisters working with the Federation of Women's Clubs to get something done. And they complained to the health department that there were spitballs all over the sidewalks, and they wanted something done about them. And the health department said, it's not our responsibility, the police are in charge. So they complained to the police, and the police didn't do anything about them. You can imagine what they said. So they decided to systematically harass the chief of police, and they organized 10 women a day to phone the chief of police and complain that this ordinance wasn't being kept. Well, after a couple of weeks, you can imagine what happened. The chief of police sent a notice around saying that police officers could arrest the offending people, usually men. And furthermore, he gave the health department also power to arrest the people. So here you have an example of the Relief Society women working together with the community work women for the community benefit. Now, to progressive America and the church, social reform was a moral issue that should be addressed by churches and reform groups. The Social Advisory Committee of the Mormon Church, operating between 1916 and 1921, was the church leader's attempt to promote social reform and moral retrenchment. First organized by the female auxiliaries to promote modest dress, the committee was soon joined by priesthood representatives and expanded to coordinate social work and retrenchment activities. The committee decided on and planned the projects while local auxiliaries implemented the program. Its goal was not to influence just the church, but also the larger society and specifically local communities. The committee was involved in drafting laws for domestic science education, juvenile courts, social work training, social reform, and other aspects of charity work. Social services became the principal concern of the Relief Society during the 1920s and 1930s. Amy Brown Lyman, who was a former vice chairman of the Social Advisory Committee, was the leader in the move for the church to address charity work in a professional manner with trained social workers. The Relief Society magazine during this time period reported on national activities and taught Mormon women the basic principles of social work so that they could help those living within their communities regardless of religious affiliation. Ultimately, the Relief Society aimed, with the cooperation of community, county, and state agencies, to help families learn how to provide for themselves. After 1933, the church's social reform seldom reached beyond its own members. According to historian Thomas Alexander, the aversion of influential church leaders, including Joseph F. Smith, to FDR's New Deal, which brought secularization to social reform, making it no longer a moral issue, motivated church leaders to look beyond the spiritual needs of their own members. At the same time, by 1930, the church had just spent three decades redefining its paradigms. As part of this process, the church increasingly centralized, placed authority firmly at the patriarchal center, and established committees creating correlation or conformity between the different sectors of the church. With each new improvement in correlation, the Relief Society lost more of its autonomy. By the time of the 1977 Utah Women's Conference held in connection with the National Year of the Woman, the church had solidified its conservative stand and Relief Society had backed away from the involvement in community service, focusing instead on serving the needs of the sisters through the visiting teaching program. Casserole dinners, baby packages, birthday cards, visits to the less active, help with household chores, and a variety of other services all became part of the meaning of modern-day in-house charity. However, with the increasing internationalization of the church, these casseroles, symbolic of service and charity, had little relevance or meaning to our international sisters. In 1991, as part of the preparations for the upcoming 1992 Relief Society Susquicentennial celebrations, President Elaine Jack toured the world asking sisters to participate in a worldwide community service project. Each local ward or branch Relief Society was asked to prayerfully choose a service project that would reach into the community and serve non-member sisters. After the completion of the project, they were asked to write an account of their service and send it to the Relief Society General Board. These accounts, and there's about 90 boxes full of them, are now stored at the Relief Society building and include the service projects as well as the ward histories and personal testimonies of the sisters' writing. The variety of projects, as you can imagine, are endless. Donating books to a local library, sewing for underprivileged unwed mothers, making Easter baskets or lap ropes for nursing homes, providing casseroles for food shelters, providing hygiene projects and toys for a battered women's shelter, tutoring students in school, visiting the sick and the elderly in hospitals and retirement homes, buying groceries for needy families, restoring part of historic buildings, and cleaning up parts of the community. Now, one of the major problems local Relief Society groups face today is the difficulty of committing to any long-term community service project. Due largely to the quick turnover in both Relief Society leadership and membership, projects chosen are often short-term. One branch in Canberra, Australia, has overcome this problem by making part of their community service unofficial. While the Relief Society cannot commit itself as an organization for any length of time, women are encouraged to volunteer their time to work with the Catholic Church Center for Teenage Counseling. The current Relief Society presidency provides the contacts and necessary arrangements. Another LDS woman in Brisbane, Australia, who works in a crisis care center, is extremely frustrated by this LDS non-commitment. All of the local churches in her area commit themselves to providing some sort of monthly help, be it a basket of groceries or a specific amount of money, and the LDS church has repeatedly refused to commit itself to a monthly gift. This is discouraging to those women who serve at the center and reflects negatively on the church's profile in that particular area. Women in the church today are much more likely to be in the workforce than previously. Thus, time has become a major deterrent for community service. A woman from Ohio explains this dilemma. Some of the challenges to the 11th Ward are apathy and commitment. The women are willing to perform service, but many are reluctant to formally commit to projects or callings. Many women work, so they hesitate to leave their families for extracurricular activities, including church. Some projects from the Susquicentennial, however, did encourage women to become involved in community service on a long-term basis. A woman from California wrote, "A few of our ward members made arrangements with the center to work there directly and still do. This was probably the best part of the project, seeing people become involved on their own and continuing to serve our community. Again, this is on an individual basis with no responsibility taken by the Relief Society for a long-term commitment." The lack of time has also loosened the ties of sisterhood within the Relief Society organization, as women have less resources with which to serve each other. many of the women I interviewed about the Susquicentennial projects wistfully spoke of times when sisters took greater care of each other. They missed the bonds of sisterhood previously shared. For example, one sister in Hurricane Utah explained that when she served as Relief Society stake president, Relief Society, however you say that, from 1987 to 1991, the Stake Relief Society presidency used to visit all the less active sisters, send cards to six sisters within the boundaries, and remember the birthdays of all the sisters in the stake by sending a birthday card at the appropriate time. Another sister in Perth, Australia, who was Ward Relief Society president from 1988 to 1989, mentioned how the Relief Society presidency took note of all active sisters who missed church each week and then phoned them on the same Sunday to make sure that all was well. And yet another sister in Salt Lake misses the midweek Relief Society meetings and the everyday contact these gatherings afforded the sisters. Perhaps the solution to the perceived loosening of bonds of sisterhood within Relief Society can be community service of the entire local group, given that each local group gets the autonomy and the resources to do so. One of the major recurring themes of the service projects was the closeness that resulted from local women working together in community service. One sister from Bountiful, Utah wrote, "The warm and loving response of sisters in this ward is wonderful. The look of joy on their faces, the feelings of love, compassion, and cooperation is bringing us closer together. We are growing closer to the Lord because we are doing what we can to help other women who are in need." Marlo Morgan, author of Mutant Message Down Under, explains, "It is necessary to shed old ideas, habits, opinions, and even companions sometimes. Letting go is a very difficult human lesson. The Aborigines of Australia traditionally lived in harmony with nature and saw animals as teachers of important tools and morals. The snake, for example, was no lesser nor greater for shedding the old. It was just necessary. New things cannot come where there is no room. Perhaps it's time for the Sisters of Relief Society to learn a lesson from the snake and continue shedding our definition of and practice of charity to suit today's needs." Thank you.
Laga, thank you. John Hurd, our final panelist, is from Boulder, Colorado, to help us understand how the Colorado or the eastern or western slope, eastern slope of the Rockies approaches this problem. John and his wife are co-public affairs directors in the Boulder Stake. He is married with two children, and I asked him if he had lived there all his life, and he said yes. So I dubbed him as a Western chauvinist in that regard. So here's John. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that one of the biggest secrets in the church these days is the resources and the capabilities of the public affairs organization within the church. Most think, as I used to think, that the main and the primary reason for public affairs was PR, news stories, press relations, and that sort of thing. But that's simply not true. A major role of public affairs is something called community relations. And I quote some of the things from the manual. It says that this community relations, including efforts to encourage individual and family community involvement by members and to coordinate organized church unit service. He goes on to say that true service has no conditions attached and no ulterior motive. It is selfless and without expectation of something in return. Now, at least in the Denver region, we are encouraged as individuals and stakes and auxiliaries in the church to get involved in our communities at every level, simply because it's the right thing to do. And we make a great effort, and it's said repeatedly in the public affairs councils that this is to be done strictly because it's the right thing to do, not for any other reason, specifically missionary efforts or anything like that. It's an outward organization. Public affairs is not a program. It's an attitude and a focus that reaches outside the church to the larger community. We have values, talents, and ideas that our communities need, and we need to share them because service to others is one of the basic attributes of a good Christian. Each ward in the church should have specialists who work with the stake public affairs directors on service projects. And as a stake and region, at least in the Denver area, that's what we're doing. There are many individuals in our stake who are personally involved in many good causes, and it was mentioned, Laga mentioned the relief societies and the efforts that they have made. They have completed major community outreach projects in connection with the 150-year celebration. And youth groups have undertaken service projects in the community. And I'd like to mention a few of the success stories that we've had recently. They're really an ongoing thing. They aren't specific projects. There is a cannery in the Denver area that is made available to all organizations in the Denver area. And this is done in coordination with church members. The idea that church members and members of the organization, whether it be the groups that are providing homeless food share and that sort of thing, get together, work at the canneries to provide this service. There are paint-a-thons of various needy single members or single people in the Denver area who need that type of service. There's a Family First Crisis Center with painting, clothing, whatever needs that are made necessary. Ronald McDonald houses of quarterly cleaning and bringing in meals. Last year in Denver, the Pope came to visit, and it was called the World Youth Day. There were hundreds of thousands of youth from around the world that came to Denver for this event, and it was potentially just an overwhelming situation for the Denver area to provide services to take care of this onslaught. The Public Affairs Regional Council coordinated the bringing together of people, members of the church, who provided translating capabilities, housing, and other arrangements. Much to the surprise of the various dioceses, Catholic dioceses within the Denver area. And this did a lot of good, both for us and for them, in terms of just overall understanding and, again, community service. There are other smaller projects, and I might mention that one of the things that should be looked at in terms of using public affairs is that it's a source of funding for projects in the wards and stakes. This happens all the time where the funds, they're essentially seed funds, a few hundred dollars to provide materials like paint, whatever, to do these projects that are available just primarily for the asking with a little planning through public service or public affairs. Things like providing Christmas trees for rehab centers in the Denver-Boulder area was done by the public affairs providing funds to do this, to provide the trees, but the work and the decorating was done by the youth of the area. Meals on Wheels, blizzard boxes were put together by a relief society. And these blizzard boxes are boxes of food and things, dried food, and delivered to people for use in cases where the normal, regular delivery of Meals on Wheels can't take place. And again, the materials and the money for those materials was provided and was made available through public affairs. And they do have a budget for this type of thing. There's an organization, a Native American organization in the Boulder area called the American Indians Science and Engineering Society, that provides training for Native Americans in the sciences starting from a very early age. And they had purchased an old abandoned scout camp in the mountains that they wanted to use as an environmental sciences training institute. Members of the church were several weekends, traveled to the mountains, and essentially tore down the old buildings and refurbished that camp. And I might say that that came about as a result of a survey where there was a very negative impression of Mormons within the community, is that the only reason that they took part in public community events was for purposes of publicity or proselytizing. And that was definitely felt by the director of this this ACES program, the Indian Science and Engineering Program. Essentially gave him the challenge that if he had a need, that we would respond, and without any proselytizing and without any publicity. And that, in fact, it happened with the members of the church. And it was just generated a good feeling. There are many other things, like the rescue missions, the halfway houses. There is that capability that is available to everyone. Elder James E. Faust addressed the public affairs meeting a year ago and explained it this way. He said, "We should not be preoccupied with the lacquered image of the church, nor worry excessively about what people are going to think." He said, "Let us go ahead and do our work. Mostly, let us do what's right for the right reason." And this attitude is not new. As a church, we have always been aware of civic responsibility. Our 12th Article of Faith talks to that issue. Joseph Smith ran for president because he felt our nation needed good leadership. And when he organized the Relief Society 150 years ago, he urged the sisters to remember not only members, but everyone with their service, and then promised them that angels would attend such efforts. To close, I'd like to just impart some personal experiences in talking about this program in my local ward and other wards. It's interesting to see the reactions of individuals. The first reaction, I think, is normal, is that there's just too much to do already within the ward affairs to get involved in community service. And this is really the easiest thing to deal with because it's just a matter of juggling priorities. But I've run into other things that concern me greatly, and that's represented by the statement of one member who is a former bishop, a former high council member, a former mission president, who said he just really couldn't get excited about it because he didn't like being with non-members. It was just not something he could deal with. And I think we're trying to overcome this. We're really trying to become part of the community. Thank you.
Okay, we've had our turn. Now it's your turn. We'd like to open it up for questions, comments, ideas, perspectives, vignettes. Yes?
I was asked to give a priesthood lesson on service, and so I researched some of the options for service in the community, volunteering in food banks and chore services and different things, and I kind of laid it out to the quorum. And at the end of the lesson, they said, "Well, Carl, since you're so service-oriented, you'll be happy to help us put in the sprinkler system for the ward softball, the state softball field." And it really frustrated me because I felt like the whole point had been missed. And I think in the church that oftentimes we think that as long as we're helping each other and doing the temple work and doing some of these things where we never even look at a non-member, that we feel like that service. And I think somehow we've got to redefine reclaim the true meaning of what service is supposed to be.
Comments? What can we do about that? What do we look to someone to change it for us, or do we do it ourselves? What, some opinions, John, whatever? We can probably do this just by projecting. So,
I think the best way is just to get them somehow involved in at least one project, because once that happens, there's a feeling there. In spite of what I told John earlier, I spent a little time in New Jersey, and one of the projects that took place there was providing a dinner during Thanksgiving at the downtown Trenton soup kitchen area, where there are a lot of homeless people. And the ward rallied and took part in that, and the result of that was just amazing because there was such a feeling – that those members who only looked at it initially as a one-shot deal got from being involved in that service was that they made it an annual tradition from then on, and it was not a formally organized thing. It was just something that they felt they needed to do.
Laga, and then another couple of questions.
I just want to play devil's advocate for a minute, because this sounds all really wonderful, and I'm very committed on individuals getting involved in community and wards getting involved with community. But what I'm finding in my studies about the Relief Society is also that we're fragmenting our own community, and that we need to find a way of making sure our community doesn't fragment at the expense, that's our expense part for going out in the community. We have to find a way that we're combining. And that's why I think, you know, if you take an auxiliary and the auxiliary works together, you're much more likely to promote the closeness in the auxiliary within our community and within the broader community. While if we take individuals and we all go out and do great work, that's wonderful. I mean, I can't praise it high enough. But we belong to the church because we all have same ideals and same beliefs, and we need to help ourselves. And within the Relief Society program, within the Relief Society organization, there's definitely a fragmentation of women because of the diverse past that women have now as compared to 1920, where there was much more a homogeneous group. And so I'm really concerned about that, and I'd be interested to hear anybody's opinion on that.
Let's take this comment. Then there were some other questions, Peggy, and I would like to respond to that as well. And then I've got you. Okay, let's start right here.
We have, in our ward, about 3 years ago, received the admission to, as a Relief Society, to do something within the community. And we, as a group, chose our object. We made a list of about five things to do. So, and sprinklers and software filters was not one of them. They didn't get a choice. So that was the one thing. We didn't let them choose that. And we chose our what we were going to do. And that was to work with the homeless shelters. Well, I volunteered with Battered Women's Alternative, and we chose the Battered Women's Program to do our work. And the community was what it brought our sisters together. Our biggest problem was lack of funds. And that was the hardest thing we were doing. And we had to move out, and we were cheap. I had a garage sale. I mean, a group of us had a garage sale to raise the money to do the purchasing. So lack of funds is our biggest problem. But another thing, we at Christmas time, one, we have a lesson on this lesson was this last fall with our brethren service to the community. One of our brethren also gave a lesson, had the same response as you did, came away very discouraged. He hooked in with the women's organization, and we continue to support it. We take three or four families, our Relief Society, and give them Christmas. We provide Christmas, and it's beyond anyone's belief what our ward does. And our team, we were very, very, very teeny tiny with the ward, and we would take Christmas for three or four families, and that's children, mothers, fathers, and provide an enormous Christmas for these families. And the men's organization kicked it down also for the first time.
Where is your community?
We're in California, Pleasantville. And the men's organization kicked into that too. He walked away from the lesson and was very discouraged. I now have started in our young women's program, we have started service with the girls, and I can't wait for the young women's They want to do service. It's the only thing that brought our girls together. One day we went to Costco and pulled the shopping carts and put the shopping carts back. Just the little things. We've also showed the open one for Kate, Brenda, and friends, and the girls are just incredibly excited about doing service. They don't seem to want to listen on anything else do they get along. But when they hear the service, the young girls are connected to that.
Peggy?
I want to ask Laga. I think most women who experienced during the 150th anniversary of the Relief Society was remarkably positive. Mm-hmm. Everyone across the globe felt that was just fabulous. The first time we were in the Relief Society as adult women that we bonded together to something that we all could be proud of. Mm-hmm. In your interviews, have you noticed, I mean, is there any attempt to sort of make this an ongoing thing and move in that direction? Or was in my world, I hear, gosh, wasn't that wonderful?
Yeah, wasn't that wonderful? Let's drop it. Yeah. It took so much time.
I really had got excited to have an idea that this was the direction of the entire Relief Society was moving in, and yet I don't see that. I see a sort of back to casseroles and that was a wonderful memory.
Okay,
that's
I think
I want to ask John for some more examples of how support structures. I mean, I think the church has the most marvelous structure in the world to do good. It's all built in into the structure. It all takes time as well. We build in the concept of voluntary work. We do it every week as a calling. Why can't we use that structure better rather than just say it's up to the individuals to be able to do it? So, those are the two questions.
You need to speak in the microphone, and so many people are going to listen to this tape, and like your comments, they won't be able to hear.
All right, so why don't we all huddle around the microphone to the extent that we're going to make comments then, and make sure that it is preserved for posterity.
Okay. First of all, I think there are individual units within, across the world, that are still doing the same type of projects that they started in the Susquehanna Centennial, and there's a lot of enthusiasm that was generated through that. The problem with the project was that it was a heads-down project. It came from the top. The top okayed it. The top okayed the money. The top okayed it. The top told the priesthood brethren to support it. What you're finding now is that local groups, I mean, we have one PR, public affairs, for the whole of Australia in Sydney. They do not give us money. I mean, you know, you're so much dependent on the bishop, and it depends on what type of bishop you have to see whether or not you get the resources. What we need to do is to somehow find a way of giving local Relief Society groups, and I'm talking specifically about Relief Society, you may want to extend this to the ward, power through giving them resources. Because if they have money, they can do things. And then get the setup, the same setup they had for the Susquehcentennial, and make it part of the bishop's responsibility that the Relief Society has the resources and availability to do local community service project. Because otherwise it comes down to individuals who do it and who encourage it, which is great when they work inside the Relief Society presidency. They move, they get released, they go in primary, and it dies. So we need to find a way of getting power back to the local works and have it as a grassroots movement coming up rather than just coming from the top down, although that did achieve a lot.
Don't you think one of the reasons why the Susquehcentennial was popular is because the instructions were so simple? Do something.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like Carolee Hawkins said, she wrote it. Mm-hmm. She wrote it with, you know, purposely, so you can choose anything. So it came from the top down, yet it was... You could be enthusiastic because you got to choose. Each group got to choose, and so that was. It wasn't instructions on do this and this and this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that certainly helped. And if they gave a mandate that was more full, long term, and say,
yeah,
we want Relief Societies to be involved in service on a long term commitment. Bishops, we want you to give them money. Priesthood brethren, we want you to help them as needed. Then you're going to keep going on those projects. But if it comes down as a once timer, then people lose interest, or they get involved within their families again. And life is much more hectic than it used to be.
Yeah, just let's finish this
okay.
Comments, then we'll come back to questions. And
okay.
I would like to comment on your comment that you made, and just speak from... I'm LDS, and I go to the ward in Salt Lake, but I'm speaking today as a panel member really on behalf of the agency that I work for, Travelers Aid Society. And I was... the contact person during the sesquicentennial year that the Relief Societies called me. And I already kind of knew what was in place because I'm LDS. But I work in an agency where out of about 75 employees, three of us are active LDS. And there is a sense among the non-LDS people there that they don't understand, you know, the structure and the procedure for getting involved. And this is one reason why I think we need to look outside of ourselves a bit and stay involved on a consistent basis with people. They see us, as, especially in Salt Lake City, as this huge resource that keeps to themselves and looks to help themselves. And it does create, I've had to advocate for the church a few times at my work, just trying to explain why for a year we had hundreds of people approaching us, hundreds. And the call was always the same, hello, I'm with the such and such ward Relief Society and we'd like to help you. What would you like us to do? As soon as that year ended, so did the calls. And I went back again to, it puts me in a precarious situation because I'm supposed to be getting volunteer support and help for the shelter. And, you know, so for a year, I really could get the, and the young women, you know, once a year have a big push to do an all-day thing. And I had, for one Saturday, no kidding, 7 wards signed up because I had people begging me, please, we don't have anywhere else to go. We need to help you now, today, tomorrow. Because it was an assignment. Never mind, could we come back next week when nobody's there. So from an agency view, it gets funny. And if I wasn't LDS, I'd probably, you know, really wonder. Being LDS, I kind of in the loop of knowing what's going on the other end, too. But I know from an agency standpoint, and people that are in the position of receiving the help get confused. This inconsistency confuses the community, and they think, okay, do we have the church? Is the church going to help us or not? They just never know, and they would like to know. They would like to know consistently, I think, what the church is involved in, and I think some of our programs need to be long-term, as you're saying, they definitely need to be long-term, they need to be consistent, and not everybody should pick the same Saturday, especially in a geographical area where there's a lot of LDS wards. Now, you know, maybe in Australia, it doesn't make a huge difference if it's in an area where there's not a lot of wards. But in Salt Lake and the surrounding, you know, Idaho and this area, definitely one project on one Saturday overwhelms the community. And then they think, wow, we finally tapped into that great resource of the LDS Church. And then it goes away, and they think, okay, we had it for a day, and we lost it. How do we get it back? And truly, people in my agency have told me, Susan, you have connections. go find out how we can get consistent help from the church, from the LDS Church.
I think Susan's comments highlight my response to you, Peggy, which is this has to become part of the fabric of what we do. What we have is we've built kind of neutral institutions, if you will, through which you can shove whatever the program is of the given, the current general authority or the current stake presidency or the current bishop. And they have no mind and heart of their own. They have no sense of what they want to do independently. And, of course, it was my understanding that we were to learn correct principles and then act for ourselves. Well, I think we have bred such centralization into our institutions is that those institutions are incapable of being mobilized for by any other force other than a downward force within it. What we are talking about now is reforming and remaking our institutions so that they have a head and heart of their own. It doesn't mean they won't respond if someone in the upper echelons gives them a job. But it means that they begin to look for and work on their own. Let me give you kind of some more examples. We have an up in our area community council. Now, this is very parochial to Salt Lake, but after all, homeless people live at very intimate and neighborhood levels. They don't kind of live in the abstract. They have to all live someplace. Everybody with a problem lives someplace. So if we can start at a community level, ultimately we can get to them. Well, what we decided is we saw that all the non-Mormons were involved in the community council. And all of the Mormons were involved in Relief Society, in priesthood, and, you know, we kind of passed one another. I hope there are no members of our community here, or if there are, I hope that they understand the spirit with which we began to attack that problem. We said, we're going to integrate those ideas, but we're going to do it informally. It is not a priesthood assignment to go over and become part of the community council. But we went anyway. We began to reorganize the community council so that we had maps, because we had them for our proselytizing purposes of who lived in every house in that community, and we began to divide them up so that they were blocks, so that neighbors related to one another. And we built block captains who don't have anything to do formally with the church, but the idea is there's going to be a neighborhood party. There is going to be a neighborhood activity, and we're going to decide among those 10 people in that neighborhood what they want to do on their block, and how does that fit with what we want to do in the community at large, and we're going to get to know one another. And we are slowly moving to conceivably change the home teaching pattern to follow then the community organizational pattern, so that home teachers are going to go out, not just to members, but we're just going to kind of go on visits, and we're going to take non-members with us, and we are going to make sure that everybody in that community has been received by somebody. So what we've done by changing the fabric, we don't have to go off and do all of our church activities and then go and try to do community activities. We are trying to mold or reshape the institution at its very essence to begin to reflect and provide us so that the work we already do, which is a lot, begins to address these community needs as well. That's what needs to happen. If we wait for another sesquicentennial, that's at least 150 years, or we wait for the bishop or the stake president who is overwhelmed or even the regional representative or the general authorities to tell us it's okay, we will likely wait for Godot. It's not going to happen unless we simply decide to do it ourselves. And the interesting part about it is when you approach the local representatives with these ideas, and we don't have to paint them in the cosmic forms that perhaps we have today, and you go in and say, I want to do this, and I want to use the priesthood to do this, or the Relief Society, you can always figure out how you can structure it so that it fits all of the biblical references and everything else that you can do it. The fact is that we don't wait around for it to get organized. We begin to reshape the institutions that we live in on a day-to-day basis. And let me tell you, it takes time. But if we can begin that outreach, pretty soon you got a community of not only Mormons, you got a community of non-Mormons as well who begin to take an interest in the people who live down the street. And that, to me, is really what it's all about. I may never be able to exert an impact beyond that, but I can at least take control of that aspect of my life. Now, that's how I think we get to it. Susan?
I would like to say with that, also what I've observed in people helping at the shelter, and again, there have been hundreds of wards helping one time, the wards that consistently come down or continue to stay have bought into helping the homeless as a group that needs their assistance rather than a leader fulfilling an assignment. So I think we have to get out of the mindset that this is an assignment, and if I don't do it well, my ward leaders are going to, you know, think that I have let them down. We put a lot of pressure, I think, sometimes in our wards that we have to have perfect Relief Society presidents and young women presidents, elder quorum presidents that are they're good because they fulfilled all the assignments we gave them. So I think we need to get a little bit away from that assignment idea, and that it needs to come from someone assigned, and then they go out and do it again, to the idea that the group buys into the idea that whatever the cause they've taken on in the community is something that that ward or that group within the ward is really going to help make an impact on, not because it was assigned or not because they're going to get checked up on, but because it's really in their heart. It's a Christian thought. It's a, I want to be like the Savior, so I'm going to help here. And when those words come in, I know it. I know when people have bought into the idea that we aren't here because we've been assigned. We're here because we want to help you. You're part of our community. We're looking out for you. We want to help. I can tell a difference between a frantic young women's president who's, you know, needs to get her group involved somewhere because, you know, otherwise she'll miss out on fulfilling her assignment. You know, there is a difference. Now, the assignment can lead to the greater understanding, so sometimes it has a purpose. But I think overall we need to buy into the feeling that we belong to and can support and help the community at large, and not to take on everything, but maybe to adopt as a ward unit a specific cause that we feel that we can take on. We've had one ward in Kearns adopt the shelter, and all year, all of their ward members have been doing things all year long and will continue next year and the year after. Their ward adopted us, and everybody wants to become a part of the issue and the resolution of the problem.
First back here, then here, then there, okay?
I wanted to ask Susan
Oh, very young. I've gone out to primaries. My favorite assignment I've ever done is gone to little primary children, including the Sunbeams, and teach them about homelessness. And we will offer that as an agency. If your group wants to do something for us, we will go out and educate them as to what we are about. Lots of times when you get a big group, like there's 100 or 200 primary kids in a ward, like in Sandy or West Jordan, they can't all come to the shelter. It's just too much to handle, and transportation is difficult for them to do that. So I've gone out. We have a video. And the little children respond. They respond because I think they have just a pureness in them that is really close to Christ. And their response is always very eager and very pure. I've talked to kids as young as three in the primaries. And in schools, we've talked to kids as young as the Head Start program. And children respond well. Teenagers always respond very well. And we've had a lot of good response, too, from the adults. But I think education about what the group is involved in is key to helping people want to take part in it and ownership of the problem. You know, it's very important that they know who they're helping and why. So I think who's ever the leader of the committee or the group that's going out needs to make sure that those that they're asking help from understand this is who we're helping, this is why they need us, this is what they're all about, and this is what we're going to do for them. Information is key.
Yes.
I'd like to see a kind of a twist to making assignments. I remember hearing from someone up in an Idaho state that they couldn't fulfill a state calling. The men couldn't. If hopefully the men, if they had facial hair, and I just thought that was so amazing, and I thought, why couldn't they think about this in a different way and say, you can't have a state calling unless you're putting 10 hours of community service into your every month. things are a little askew, or you know, we talk about going on missions all over the world, but what about a community mission? Of calling people to community missions right in their little community and fulfilling that kind of charitable work.
Well, I think those are more examples of the way you've got to kind of breathe this into the fabric of the institution and the way it thinks, that we can do a lot of the busyness in which we're engaged and we can reorient it and recalibrate it, I think, to cover this. But I think what this is symptomatic of, and I think all of our interest, is that we are thinking about the church differently than they did 40 or 50 years ago or 60 years ago. And there were historical reasons that brought them to that view of themselves and of the world. We've got a new view of the world. I think many of us want to engage in that activity. We want to bring the church along with us or our local communities because that field, we like that. And I think that's the revolution that we have to be engaged in. Question, and then Barbara? Oh, am I not? You know, Barbara, I speak loudly enough that I'm confident on the...
Well, that's...
he will write you a check.
The question was that you hadn't heard of the public affairs as being a funding portion of the church for this type of activity. And that came as a revelation to me, too, when I first entered public affairs. I guess all I could suggest is agitate from your local level because it's written in the manual for public affairs to be part of community, or that community relations is a major part of that. And as far as funding goes, all I can really say out of direct experience is that the council that I'm involved in, regional council, brings in these yearly plans from the stake level that all have funding requirements with them, sends them on through to Salt Lake. All these funds come from Salt Lake. It's not a local level. So I guess all I could say is find out exactly what or who is supposed to be responsible for public affairs in your area and start agitating clear to the top because it's there.
here and then there. Question?
We just moved into a ward that neither began or stopped with the Sesquicentennial Relief Society projects. It's been an ongoing thing for years. Our president is Roseanne Gunther. I don't know if you've heard of her, but she's done a lot of, she's initiated a lot of service projects through the Humanitarian Division of the Church, and has come out with guidelines so that the young women can make baby blankets for people in Eastern Europe. And my daughter is a Laurel project for her 80 hours, gathered and put together 50 hygiene kits that are sent out to people when there's some kind of a disaster. And the kits have things like toothbrushes and razors and washcloths and soap and, you know, just some of the real necessary items you would need if your home was destroyed or you had to leave it all of a sudden. And these are sent out by the church when there is a disaster somewhere. So we felt it was a real worthwhile project. But my calling in this new ward, and I don't have a committee yet because the bishop hasn't called them, but I will have a group of women who will commit to 2 hours a week to get together and do whatever we need to do as a service project in our community. And right now we're working with the women's shelter, making some dish towels and diapers and baby clothing and things like that that they need. And then it will be my job to search my community and get together with some of the other churches in American Fork, some of the non-LDS ones, to do some community projects that will benefit the people right there where we live.
Okay, a question quickly. Where do you get the money?
I don't know because I'm just new at this. I've never done it yet.
Go ahead, and then.
For my daughter's project, we sent out a flyer, and she went around the ward and asked for donations of money or these particular items, and she was able to do 50 entire kits with it.
One other thing that we do in our ward, because we don't have the money, and really quickly, we give assignments of 5 thank yous a day and come back and report. So if we can't do service, actual service, try to think of things that don't cost money. 5 thank yous that you can never give to anyone. And there's books out that give all these little examples.
Yes.
A clarification question for John. Every ward can or is supposed to have a public affairs or community relations coordinator. And could you go to your bishop and just say, I don't want to be that?
Gee, is that the way it's done?
Every stake is supposed to have a public affairs director, and it's my understanding every ward is supposed to have a specialist that works with that stake director. Now it's, you know, varies on a local basis, but that's the way it's supposed to be.
We've got about 3 minutes left before our time is out. I would like to ask the panelists if they have any final comments or questions that they'd like to comment.
Okay, I think the dialogue today has been very interesting, but you've got to realize this is very centralized to America. I've spent 10 years in Holland, 10 years in New Zealand, and 10 years in Australia, and I know how the church works on the periphery, and it doesn't work this way. And I think there has to be some cautious. We can't do the same type of community building that you suggested because you tend to get first and second generation Mormons who have a different mindset. It's very much we obey the leaders. It hasn't fermented. You've got so many generations going back here. Most people are born Mormon and vitally feel with everything in their being that they're Mormon because that's the way they were born and that's the community they're given into. So they have that a different mindset of what being Mormon is and how you can transfer that to the community than people on the periphery who join the church later in life and who try very hard to follow the leader's words. And if a local bishop says, I will not give you funding or I really don't think you should be concerned with that, that cuts it off for them. And I think we need to think of some creative ways to help new members on the periphery learn the things that people here already know and take that and make it more international so that we can all benefit from it.
Susan, any final comment?
I just wanted to comment. I think that the church can be a positive force in the community and that it just is a grassroots effort. And I think we need to caution ourselves not to become, especially in Salt Lake, because I'm speaking from a receiving agency in Salt Lake that sees the church as something that is hard to tap into. I think we need to just make sure that we don't become elitist in our views and our ideas, but that we do stay globalized and put our efforts to grassroots concerns and working within our communities to help everyone.
John?
I guess two things. One is to learn to use the system. As I've said before, I think there are programs involved in the system that we don't know about, and it's big enough and bureaucratic enough that there's something probably there if we can get to it. The other thing that's probably more important is this really is an individual thing. The best thing we can do is act as good examples ourselves and get involved ourselves and bring our friends into it.
I'll close here with about 2 seconds. I think my summary of what we've heard from the panel basically comes down to two issues, which they've reiterated. One is we have to take individual action and responsibility, not necessarily to become fragmented, but to start our own institutions working and to start ourselves working. Secondly, we need, if we can, to reform or redirect the focus of the existing institutions, not by being angry at it, but rather beginning that change from within. And I do believe we have the capacity and ability to do that if we'll just begin to work at that. And I think if we do it that way, then reform on the fringes, such as it is, can occur in the means and in the way they can do it. We can reform in each location based on who we are, which I think the wonderful aspect of it. And the final reminder would be, inasmuch as ye have done this unto the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me. Thank you.